Pierce, Stone, Gossier, no names of mine. The vixen I met at twilight on Route 5 south of Lake Willoughby, long dead. She was an omen to me, surviving, herding her cubs in the silvery bend of the road in 1965. Shapes of things, so much the same, they feel like eternal forms. The house and barn on the rise above May Pond, the brow of Pisgah, the face of milkweed blooming, brook water pleating over slanted granite, Boletus under pine, the half-composted needles it broke through, patterned on its skin. Shape of Queen Anne's lace with the drop of blood, bladder campion veined with purple, multifoliate heal-all. I refuse to become a seeker for cures, for heal-alls. Everything that has ever helped me has come from what already lay stored in me. Old things, diffuse, unnamed, lie strong across my heart. This is from where my strength comes, even when I miss my strength, even when it turns on me like a violent master. From where? The voice asks coldly. This is the voice in cold morning air that pierces dreams. From where does your strength come, old things? From where does your strength come, you southern Jew, split at the root, raised in a castle of air? Yes, I expected this. I have known for years the question was coming. From where? Not from these, surely, Protestant separatists, Jew baiters, night riders who fired in Irisburg in 1968 on a black family newly settled in these hills. From where? The dew grows thick late August on the fierce green grass and on the wooden sill and on the stone. The mountains stand in an extraordinary point of no return, though still a green. Collapsed shed boards gleam like pewter in the dew. The realms of touch-me-not, fiery with tiny tongues, cover the wild ground of the woods. With whom do you believe your lot is cast? From where does your strength come? I think somehow, somewhere, every poem of mine must repeat those questions, which are not the same. There is a whom, a where, that is not chosen, that is given, and sometimes falsely given. In the beginning, we grasp whatever we can to survive. All during World War II, I told myself I had some special destiny, that there had to be a reason I was not living in a bombed-out house, eating gray bread, hiding out with rats from the enemy. There had to be a reason. I was growing up safe, American, with sugar rationed in a mason jar, split at the root, white-skinned, social Christian, neither Gentile nor Jew, in the immense silence of the Holocaust. I had no idea of what I had been spared, still less of the women or men, my kin, the Jews of Vicksburg or Atlanta, whose lives must have been strategies no less than the vixens on Route 5. If they had played the flute or chess, I was told. I was not told what they told their children, how they listened when the Klan rode, how they may have seen themselves, a chosen people of shopkeepers, clinging by strategy to a way of life that had its own uses for them, proud of their length of sojourn in America, deploring the latecomers, the peasants from Russia. I never heard of their beliefs, only of their acculturation. I saw my father building his rootless ideology, his private castle in air, in that most dangerous place, the family home. We were the chosen people. In the beginning, we grasp whatever we can. In Maryland, the stars showed liquescent, diffuse in the motionless summer nights. The constellations blurred. I thought I was leaving a place of enervation, heading north where the drinking gourd stood clear and steady at last, pointing the way. I thought I was following a track of freedom, and for a while it was. Getting to me? Is there something going on? There's a beat. I'm sort of ignoring it. I think in a couple of those sections I was moving in toward what I really was after. But the poem then veers a lot, and it tries to take in what is the moral and political significance of New England as a place, and various other rather removed issues. And then this section follows. It's an old-fashioned and outrageous thing to believe one has a destiny, a thought often peculiar to those who possess privilege, often one of the most destructive manias of privilege, but also a sustaining thought for those who know themselves a historical people, however despised or undermined, who know they are not merely the sum of damages done to them, who have kept beyond violence the knowledge, arranged in patterns like Kente cloth, unexpected as in batik, of being a connective link in a long, continuous way of ordering weather, hunger, death, desire, and the nearness of chaos always. Well, that's all very well and maybe true, but I feel as if it's a tremendous sort of effort to intellectualize and to distance what I was getting too close to. And then comes a passage which I was very frightening to me to write, because he'd said something that I hadn't realized that I felt. The Jews I have felt rooted among are those who were turned to smoke. When I read of the chimneys against the blear air, I feel I have seen them myself. The fog of northern Europe licking along the railroad tracks to the place where all tracks end is more substantial to me than the linen cloth on Friday nights, the challah, the scrub linoleum, in the poorest village or tenement where women were not intended to study or pray. I cannot feel for the Talmudist with his hatred of my woman's hair and blood, my woman-desiring body. But when I read of any Jew hurled to the edge of things, feminized, proscribed, made into a demon, not because women were not taught to pray, but because Europe needs its dark outsider, and every Christian city its lightning rod, I know I am on acute and personal ground. Well, I wasn't even sure that I was going to read that here, because it seemed to me such an in-process stage of thinking about these things. But it is a piece that has to be acknowledged in some way. It is true in the sense of a piece of consciousness that I had to give voice to, realize that I was carrying around in me maybe not what I wish I felt, but what I was feeling. It's when the words came out on paper that I felt the terror. Not before, I wouldn't have been able to write it. That happens sometimes. I feel as if the rest of the poem veers off in a lot of directions. that it's almost a movement to and fro, back and forth, getting too close to the heat and pulling away again. There are things in it that I feel it was important for me to have said, important for me to have written. As a poem, as something that I would plant, as you said, like the shard in the earth with the inscription, and pull out again at a time of need when I needed contact with some power from myself that I had temporarily lost track of. No, it isn't that, and this poem as it exists could never be that for me. I will always hold on to this draft of it as a graph for me of where I, what I was trying for and failing at, what I was going through at this time. And that's, I think that there's another use of poetry, which is of the poem that you don't publish at all, the poem that you don't necessarily read in public at all, except perhaps in this way. But that you don't burn, tear into shreds either. Keep it, because it's a record. It's a record of where you've been. It's a record also maybe of deceptions you've practiced on yourself and defenses you've used to wall yourself away from the things that ultimately you could say.
But you know, Adrienne, sometimes I wonder too if that isn't also another definition of poetry. I guess I hear you saying that this is not the poem you want to write, but it is a poem that you are writing. And it's useful not just to you as a record for you, but it's useful to all of us too, in that sense. Not just in this dialogue, but as a work, as a piece.
I guess what I feel is that there are, that it can be so much more useful, first to me and then to anyone else, if I can do something about what I perceive as the fear, not to pretend, not to have the poem come out sounding as if there had been no fear, but to address the fear in the poem rather than have the fear inform the poem.
That's another poem.
Okay.
It feels to me.
I want to say, just by way of parenthesis in all of this, that it seemed one of the things that gave me the courage to read this tonight at all, and to talk about it at all to the extent that I've been able to, was reading the article by Irena Klepfisch in Woman News, the current Woman News, called Antisemitism in the Lesbian Feminist Community. It's a very clear, very strong piece, and Irena Klepfisch is a poet and writer of fiction whose work has meant a great deal to me for a very long time. And her article gave me a kind of map or structure, I suppose, which I feel I can work within and around in thinking about a lot of what I have to think about if I'm going to finish this poem or the poem that I think this poem is leading to. And I just wanted to recommend it to all of you who might be interested. That's in Woman News.
I want to continue listening, of course, and not have to talk out.
It's yours.
The poems I've been working on recently that have created the most problem for me are poems, as with Adrienne, that will not finish themselves yet. And although one of them, they're really a frame of poems, and I refer to them as poems for women in rage, but they cover, for me, a large arc. The first that has become, perhaps, the most is a poem called After Images, which was published in Sinister Wisdom, 17. And in the poem, I tried to bring together two very painful and very circumscribed, however, occurrences in my life that intersected within me. And one of them, the genesis of the poem, started in 1978 during the summer, when on the 6 o'clock news I saw the flooding of Jackson, Mississippi. And you know what happens on the 6 o'clock news, the microphone is thrust into your face when your life has collapsed around you. And they were doing that to a woman, to a white woman about my own age, who was totally riven with the loss of everything she had had. And her pain was so naked and so complete on the 6 o'clock news that I saw it that she would have moved stone, and certainly me as a woman feeling what she was. And like a fire cut across that was my connections, my first connections with Jackson, Mississippi, which was the death of Emmett Till, which is perhaps a name that I don't know how many of you know here, but he was a 15-year-old black boy who was castrated, burned, and tortured to death in 1955 because he whistled on the streets of Jackson while a white girl passed. And this woman who really reached into my heart, into my woman's heart, was the same age group as this woman would have been, the girl who passed by and for whom Emmett Till was tortured and killed. And as I saw the destruction of Jackson, I saw this woman's face, and I saw Emmett Till as a ghost riding across it, the need for me to deal with, inside myself, the ways in which all of these came together was overwhelming. But the poem was a very difficult one to write because as I started, I was pulled between two poles, and I constantly said, and I remember saying to Adrian, I guess there are two poems here, but they were not, because the poem itself, the process was putting them together, being able to put them together. And that poem, which is perhaps the first of Women in Rage poems, as difficult as it was, once it was done, and it did not end again as I would have thought or even perhaps wanted it to, but it feels, and I'm not going to read it now only because there are a couple of other things I want to talk about, and I think that we're getting on, but you can find it in Sinister Wisdom 17, which is a magazine you should read anyway, and also it is in, the title of it is After Images. But this poem, as difficult as it was to write, to maintain, for instance, with some kind of integrity, the me on both sides of this, as Adrian says, this fulcrum, was still a poem dealing with events that had happened outside of myself and therefore how I experienced them. And I'm talking now, of course, poetry is experience, but we experience things in different places, in different relationships to us. And the range of these poems perhaps comes up with a poem that I have not brought the artifacts, or I have not brought the pieces here, because they are sometimes even illegible to me. But they will work themselves out. And this is a poem that the working title of which is Outlines. And it is a poem in the cycle of the poems of Women in Rage. And at the same time, it reaches not out of something separate and my response to it, but my own, my very living. And in Outlines, I've tried to do what I have with all of these poems, which is to examine how I use difference, how we all use difference, how it can be used creatively, constructively, and at the same time, not to negate, not to deny, not to negate the effects of difference within our lives, how we have been distorted by it, how we have been hurt by it, and how we use it sometimes not at all constructively, but destructively. And to examine these, what does this mean, for instance, within my life, that my day-to-day living, that I am a black woman, dedicated and committed to the struggle of all people of color, dedicated and committed in particular to the struggles of women of color, black women. What does it mean that I grow, live, continue, empower myself within a 14-year relationship with my white lesbian lover? How do I examine the pieces of my life and bring them together in a way not only that makes sense, but that is useful as a process. And this is the material that I work with, that I am working with, out of who I am, within outlines. And it is tremendously difficult. It's tremendously difficult not to want to present something that is politically correct, to present something that tells lies because they're sometimes more comfortable. This does not become a poem. The poem is still in the process. And of course, it deals with rage and despair, death as that ending, and change with creativity and growth. But most of all, I guess, with the need to be myself in all of my complexities. As I said before, not to tell lies because they may be more comfortable or even sometimes more useful. And I guess that I would just end this discussion with the piece of outlines which I guess feels the most finished to me and is the end of one part of it. And it's perhaps something that I hold on to as I go through the morass of the rest of the poem, and it is the final part, examining the relationship between Francis and me, examining the way we move through our worlds, through our separateness, through our difference, and through that thing which we make together and how it empowers us. We have chosen each other and the edge of each other's battles. The war is the same. If we lose, someday women's blood will congeal upon a dead planet. If we win, there is no telling. We seek beyond history for a new, more possible meaning. I would like to close this with thanking you all and hoping that you've gotten some piece of the kind of excitement that Adrienne and I have gotten, and perhaps not quite so much of the terror, but enough of the terror to perhaps use.
If I understand the question correctly, I'll just repeat it. You're interested to have further explanation or explication of the notion of distance between the feeling and the actual writing of the poem?
Yes.
No. I think what I was trying to say was that that poem Transit came to me as a kind of visionary thing, and I was indeed beginning to try to cope with the acceleration of physical disability in my life, but I had by no means begun to think of it as something that I really had to work on. As far as my feelings were concerned, I was dealing with it in a very ad hoc, day-to-day, practical, you know, basis, and distancing it very much from myself, from my whole self. The poem came as a kind of very welcome image, vision, and I guess what I was trying to say was that it was not a poem that was difficult to write in the sense of the poem that I was just talking about here now, because I was in a sense even unaware that there was this problem. I mean, it was obvious that the poem came from a very deep place in me, but it was not something that I was trying to work toward or out of or anything. It was more like a poem that comes out of a dream. That's what I meant. It was distanced in the sense that there were these two kind of mythic images of the skier and the cripple, and I wasn't talking directly about my day-to-day self. That's all.
Since they're only doing two, does anyone have a question for Audrey?
I know you love me.
And also,
okay. Yeah, I have a question that I'd like both folks to address. The French intellectual presence are involved in something right now.
I can't respond to that. If you have a question, you can phrase it another way. If you have a question, you can phrase it another way, but I can't respond to what I hear you starting to do.
Well, she was asking about the French feminist, and we heard Audrey respond. Well, there's a crack in your question. Go ahead.
The écriture féminine, or writing from the body, is that how you see your own poetry, if you see it at all, aligned with that or related to it? How you see
what's going on there, if you have any value to your work, or feminist work, or way of writing. Yeah, I think the question is about a school of thought of the French feminist poets who are writing, you said, from the body,
right.
And you're wondering how these two poets relate to that phenomenon.
I can't answer your question, I'm sorry.
I don't read their writings, so I guess I can't answer it either. I'm sorry. I mean, I have a lot of problem with intellectual academic feminism, and I have a lot of problem with you know, I think that we could talk here about our, you know, I think that probably both of us could talk about a lot about the body, but it would be in very, very different terms.
Bravo. Thank you, Adrienne.
Stuff. We want to thank our poets before they leave.